Well, you've asked for it, and here it is, the show on Malachi Martin. Malachi Martin, his stock is going up because of all the scandals in the church, pedophilia, homosexuality, all things that Malachi Martin was saying in his novels and in his books into the 90s. But today, Timothy Gordon and I are going to talk about why maybe Malachi Martin is not that trustworthy. We're going to go through his entire history, some of the sketchy things, his whole timeline, all the way up until his death, when he seems to have died as a sede vacantis, rejecting the papacy. So it seems. He also was living with a Greek woman at that time. I'll go ahead and throw up on the screen. There's Malachi Martin's tombstone. And you can see that he's buried with his roommate, the Greek woman, who seems to have been bankrolling him, though we don't know all the details. So there's some interesting things. He seems to know a lot, but there's some sketchy stuff. So, Tim, welcome back. What do you think about Malachi Martin?
What I think about Malachi Martin is, when you speak about him, if you want to speak about him sensibly, you end up sounding like a first-year law student, which by which I mean this. You say allegedly after everything, right?
Right.
I'll never forget first-year law student. I don't play the allegedly game. I'm like, I look at a guy, a criminal. This is probably why I'm not in crim law, right? I look at a guy, I'm like, face tattoo, guilty. You know, like, and you know, I'm just messing around. I know technically, procedurally, he's owed more than that.
Right.
But other first-year law students would be like, that's allegedly 1L. It's like, I realize that, dude.
Yeah. But face tattoos are kind of scary, aren't they?
Face tattoos mean that something has gone terribly, terribly awry.
I was at a jiu-jitsu tournament last year, and I saw this guy. He was my size. He was pretty strong looking, covered in tattoos, including face tattoos. And I was like, right. Man, that would be horrible if you had to fight that guy. Right?
It would.
I get called up for my first match. There he is. Face tattoo,
did
man.
Did you beat him?
No, he beat me. He beat me.
He beat you? Yeah. He was legit. Was he Brazilian?
No. He was somewhere from the Midwest. I looked him up later. I Googled his name and I found that his online handle was Thug Daddy.
Oh.
Yeah.
And so he's a father.
He is. Yeah.
just kidding.
He has lots of tattoos. So anyway, I think I lost just because I was so scared of the face tattoos.
Yeah. You're
I was intimidated,
dude.
Like, I had no hope at that point. I'm like, I'm going up against the guy with the face tattoo.
Did you cry a teardrop?
He had a teardrop. Yes. And he had other things as well. Something like over his eyebrow.
Don't let him get at you in reverse guard.
I know.
No, but what I mean, I'm sorry you lost to him, but I'm just getting deep.
Yeah.
But what I mean is, with Malachi Martin, you actually probably want to be agnostic, to speak analogically. You want to say
allegedly.
Why? Because it's so damned hard to ascertain what's actually real and what's not.
He's complicated.
He's a complicated human being. Well, I mean, what do you think? I think we're online on this. Like,
I've spent hours now studying him, prepping for the show. Actually, I mean, it's been months that I've been looking into it and reading his stuff and you know, searching and trying to find data and photos and things. And at this point, I think I would say he's sketchy. He probably was a double agent working for both sides. And I think that a lot of the things that he says about the state of the church are in fact true, because he is so dirty and he knew about the dirty things going on in the church. Not that he necessarily participated in them, but he was in those circles to know, by which I mean primarily Jesuit circles in the 60s.
Dirty circles.
Dirty circles. And you know, people know Malachi Martin primarily. Oh, and then the name. I've been saying Malachi Martin for years, and then lately I've been hearing all the people online saying Malachi.
Malachi.
So I switched it, which is more Latinate, but I've been listening, and he calls himself Malachi.
Malachi.
So for the record, we're calling him Malachi Martin. Yeah. Because I know everyone's going to, you know, you're saying it wrong.
Don't correct our accents, people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So don't do it.
He's, you know, he has a colored background. I think we should go over his early life timeline and then get into the controversy of his laicization, which is a big debate amongst people. And then we'll move into, we were talking earlier before we were running video here about basically three different camps of Catholics who either accept or reject Malachi Martin and their reasons. I think people would find that interesting too. For example, Sede Vacantists hate Malachi Martin. And there's reasons for that.
It becomes the Sedes versus the SSPX and close groups to SSPX.
It's interesting, yeah.
It feels diametrical. When you bring up the topic of Malachi Martin,
yeah,
the Sedes and the SSPX, really, they're big rivals anyway. But it's interesting to see the way that the constellation of indicia work when it plays to the advantage of SSPX to say Malachi Martin is semi-credible or credible, and it plays to the advantage of the Sedes to say the opposite, SSPB, as it were.
And then the liberals themselves want to discount Malachi. So before we get into that, we got to get into what he's actually saying and why they would say that. So Malachi Martin, he's born in County Kerry, Ireland, on July 23rd, 1921. He has a Gaelic name that I'm not even going to try to pronounce because there's way too many consonants and vowels slammed all together. But it is the Gaelic form of Malachi, who is a prophet of the Old Testament. There's also Saint Malachi. People know of the Saint Malachi prophecies, which give a little prophecy for each pope all the way to the end of time to Peter the Roman. I personally think that those prophecies are bunk. You got an opinion on that, Tim?
Yeah.
The glory of the olives and the whole thing.
No, I know. I mean, anytime you engage in prophecy that involves descriptive language, it starts feeling like Nostradamus. Like, exactly. Oh, he called the two towers are going to fall because he said twin giants are bound to come down. It's like, that's not calling 9/11, dude. So there's that aspect. There are a few credible dimensions of the St. Malachi prophecies, but and he was friends with St. Bernard, right? Wasn't he?
Yeah, best but we don't know if those prophecies go back to him.
No, because the first production of them is like more recent than the provenance, as art historians say. The provenance is not what you'd like it to be. But that so no, I'm with you.
I'm open to it, but
by proponents, I'm open
when
to
people
it.
Are like, well, the St. Malachi prophecy, I'm like, I'm going to tune out at that point.
Then again, the last 5 years, maybe it's a little less.
If you follow it, the second to last pope would have been Benedict, and the final pope is the current one, Francis, but he should be called Peter the Roman. I don't know. I guess he seems kind of antichrist. I mean, I guess we give Francis some time to see if he fills the shoes, but I don't know.
I mean, then again, the one thing that we've dealt with in all of the Fatima videos, the Akita, good success, what you're calling the centrists in the church, they always try to raise provenance issues, right? Like Our Lady of Good Success, there's this one scholar of Our Lady of Good Success, Dr. Horvat, Miriam Horvat, and she's studied it in detail, and she says there are no provenance issues. This goes all the way back. It's well documented. But if you talk to a Novus Ordo type that's a little bit of a know-it-all, they say, oh, the problem with Our Lady of Good Success, it's a valid apparition, though the prophecies are super recent.
Yes.
And so people throw this in your way, and it's like, I don't know.
That's why I've delayed on us doing Our Lady of Good Success. Everyone's like, good success every day in the comments. Good success. And because of those reasons, I know the objections that are out there. We just need to get someone who is a scholar on it, like Horvat or Father Purdy or one of these people who's done their homework to answer those objections.
Right. My point in bringing it up, you're exactly right. My point in bringing it up is simply these issues are the favorite nit to pick of doubters and naysayers. And in the case of today's topic, I think it's valid. It seems to be valid naysaying, which is what we're about to get into.
Yep. So Malachi Martin becomes a novice with the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits, September 6, 1939. In 1945, this is just kind of a side note, there's a cardinal named Cardinal Bea. He will become more important as we move into this timeline. He issued this whack version of the Latin Psalter that was based on the Hebrew. That was not the one that's used in Gregorian chant. It caused a lot of problems, came out during Pius XII. Anyway, I'm not a big fan of Cardinal Bea, and I just want to throw it out there because I think it's a problem. Sometimes you'll see a Latin Psalter if it says Cardinal Bea anywhere in there, you don't want it.
Seems to be utterly politically motivated. His
yes.
Allegedly, he's the guy behind the kind of liberalization of Nostra Aetate, and yes. he had this sort of fascination with
Judaism
and over vindicating it. Maybe I mean we want to be good with all peoples of the earth and hold hands and wear bad sandals and sing hymns like you hear at the Novus Ordo,
right.
But we don't want to go too far and say that they're off the hook. Bea definitely seemed to be in that camp, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And we'll see that also with Malachi Martin here shortly.
Martin.
So in 54, on this Feast of the Assumption, Malachi Martin was ordained a priest. And it seems from 54 to 58, Malachi Martin was a paleontologist doing biblical paleontology at the Pontifical Biblical Institute. I like that. I took a biblical paleontology course at Texas A&M when I was a student there. It was one of my favorite classes in the 4 years. So I kind of like this. He also wrote a book, a 2-volume that came out in 58. This is Malachi Martin, The Scribal Character of the Dead Sea Scrolls. So he's some kind of an early expert in the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yes.
Pretty smart.
I've heard him talk on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. IQ through the roof, according to all accounts. His naysayers, his fanboys, everyone says, He's a Swiftie. He's a real Sharpie.
He's genius.
Yeah. He's just a genius. Yeah.
Yeah. Knows a lot of languages. A genius. Yeah. So from after that, he gets kind of famous and he gets pulled in to Rome. And from 58 to 64, he's the private secretary or some sort of private auxiliary for Cardinal Bea. And by the way, Cardinal Bea is a Jesuit. So you can see this connection.
He's a German. People don't think he's a German because that name is not so Teutonic sounding.
Exactly.
He's a German Jez. Yeah.
So, and Bea was I believe Cardinal Bea was the father confessor to Pius XII. I think that's correct. Hmm. I'm going off memory on that, but I'm pretty sure that Bea was that well respected by Pius XII. So from 58 to 64, that's when Malachi Martin is working for Bea. This is also obviously the time of John the 23rd and the starting of the Second Vatican Council. When, you know, and you've talked about it before, Tim, where we have shadow councils going on, documents being drafted. What were they doing that? Angelicum or the Greg?
The Greg is where the shadow councils were.
Yeah.
But also remember, 58-59 is an interesting time because the one or two transcribed versions of the Third Secret are sent over in the spring of 58, I believe. Don't quote me on dates, but 58, they're sent to the Vatican from Portugal. And allegedly Sister Lucy during this time, according to Antonio Socci, who I trust, says that Sister Lucy is getting very squirmy once John the 23rd, a known Fatima skeptic,
doubter,
not a fan, doubter, has taken the throne of Peter. She's getting very squirmy and is allegedly, by multiple accounts, even because Malachi Martin is so important for Fatima, has tied himself in with Fatima, I should say. She's getting squirmy and is even suggesting wacky things since the new pontificate became underway, like getting on the radio waves and announcing then in early 1960, she's saying, I'd like to do this before this pontificate gets underway, because she knew what was happening.
Yeah.
This is a little
diminutive.
She
wanted to start a podcast.
Right.
Yeah.
She wanted to be on this podcast.
Yes, she wanted to.
She was a seer. She'd heard that this was coming down the pipe.
That's right.
Or
what was the famous quote of John the 23rd regarding the seers? You've said it
called
before.
Called them prophets of doom.
Prophets of doom.
According to Socci. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, that's really, he wrote it in a private correspondence.
That'd be a great doom metal band name.
Prophets of doom. Yeah. No. There's probably 12 bands, Norwegian black metal. It's already copyrighted.
Done it.
Yeah.
So in 59, We've said before, we've debated if it's night in our Fatima videos, 60 or 59, when John the 23rd opens the letters. And I think we determined it was actually in 59. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, well, there are two accounts of it, and it is the most more popular account is 59, is when he opened it right after he announced the convocation of the council.
And allegedly, Cardinal Bea was there for the opening and for the translation. And this is the famous incident. This is what makes Malachi Martin so famous in Catholic circles. It's this claim, whether it's true or not, that either he was in the room or he was in the hallway. His bedroom was nearby. He overheard what was read in the Third Secret of Fatima on that fateful day in 1959, when John the 23rd said, allegedly, this is not for my pontificate.
Not for my pontificate. Yeah. Which is a weird thing to overhear. I mean, if it's this secret, the fate of the world.
Like, was he bringing in like cappuccinos and like you heard him talking like back out into the hallway and like listen?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. What do you mean? And the interesting thing is he'll never specify whether he's bringing cappuccinos or whether it was bagels or a little frittata or what. Right. And even when you go listen to the Art Bell interviews, he kind of asks him about it. And one of them, he's like, okay, so you overheard, like, he was kind of trying to say nicely, like, dude, were you eavesdropping? Or this is super secret. This is a big deal.
Right.
And you overheard. And he's kind of just like, he breezes past it. He's like, yeah, I overheard it. And then he starts talking about what he says they mean. And the other really stark thing that always made me suspicious of Malachi Martin, even in moments I've had where I kind of wanted to believe all, you know, the limerick charm that is Malachi Martin.
Yes.
Is why not reveal, dude? You're saying you're pro revelation of the Third Secret. You're on board for it was supposed to be revealed in 1960. There is 3B. The existence of 3B is real. It's extant. Right. And it's a great disobedience, by the way. Why not tell us, dude? He'd be like, no, I can only kind of hint. He's like, he's making it up on the spot.
I mean, in part of our case for 3B, for part of the Third Secret not having been revealed, that's the position that Tim and I hold. It's the Antonio Socci thesis. We hold that. And we've done videos on it. So don't try to fight us on us here. Go watch those old videos. Not old, but a few months old.
Couple.
Yeah. But we say in our video, part of our case, it's not only based on Malachi Martin, but part of our case is based on the idea that Malachi Martin heard the second part of the Third Secret, what we call 3B, and that it has to do with things that are not spoken of in 3A. Now, if someone by the end of this interview could prove that Malachi Martin lied and he didn't overhear this at all, he just made it up to look cool on Art Bell, I would still hold to 3B. I don't think our case hinges.
No, yeah.
Upon for sure. Malachi Martin being truthful.
Oh, well, I always made explicitly sure as I read every page of Sochi's book and as I watched, there's a documentary on YouTube. People go watch it. It's Chris Ferrara and some of the Remnant people are behind it. He's a sharp guy, whether you agree with everything there. He's a reputable guy, a lawyer. Terry Schiavo
doesn't
lawyer.
Always go together. Though.
Doesn't
he's
usually
a reputable
go together,
guy,
my
a lawyer.
A reputable and a sharp guy, not usually lawyers, in my experience. And I have some experience there. No, but it's called The Secret Still Silenced. It's really entertaining.
It's a video?
An hour and a half. It's a video on YouTube.
Someone loaned that DVD back when we did DVDs a while back. Yeah. I remember watching that.
It's got good music and stuff. It's very atmospheric.
Maybe I'm wrong here, Tim. Isn't it basically kind of an hour DVD of the Antonio Socci hypothesis?
Right.
With other people in it?
With other people. Yeah. It does have some Gruner appearances who has this relationship with Martin. They stare pretty clear of Martin, but the case is really independently built. And every time I watch that video, I watch it every 6 months or so. Mm-hmm. I show it to my students usually. And then when I read Sochi's book, every page, I was like, okay, this all checks out irrespective of the, you know, limerick enigma of Malachi Martin. And I always was comforted by that. Like this is independent of him. And I think, by the way, he's also a smarty pants. So the fact that I guess you and I both believe was making up what he was saying to Art Bell. He might have been able to reason to it a priori. It's not that tough. You know, it's not that tough to reason to what it probably meant. He still might be right. I just don't think he overheard it carrying a tray of cappuccinos.
Right. Maybe he did.
Maybe.
Even if he did, he never told us what it was. So it's a little bit irrelevant.
To give these like babyish hints. And it's like, mm-hmm. come on, dude, is this real or not? Same thing with like all the stuff he claimed to know that I guess we're going to talk about. This is the thoroughgoing theme for me with Malachi Martin is like, why give the hints? Why write in faction? Why give me 90% of the thing? Just say it, you know? Right. I mean, we've talked about that with lots of
figures. Well, because he had a very successful fiction career, you know, and people bought the fiction and just like I have and you have, you read Windswept House and you're like, oh, that's so-and-so, and that's Cardinal so-and-so, and that's Cardinal Velo, and oh, he's alluding to, you know, John Paul I being whacked, you know, poisoned, and it's very exciting to read those things, right?
It is.
So if he just goes on Art Bell and just, you know, gets us everything he's got, no one's going to buy those novels anymore. Part of his mystery was being Oz behind the curtain and pulling all the levers and
that's true.
And amazing that's us, right. You know?
Yeah, I mean, like every philosophy student, everyone who's ever been a graduate philosophy student loves in their philosophy department to go look at Raphael's School of Athens. And then usually somewhere in the department, they'll have the key, right, for who's who in the School of Athens. Right. I think, you know, my philosophy department had one. It was really neat to look at, like, oh, this is so-and-so. That there's literally a key, just like the key for School of Athens, for Windswept House. Yes. You used to talk about it quite often.
If you read Windswept House, you go online, you find the key. There's many places that have it. You print it out, and you fold it in half, and you put it in your copy of Windswept House. So when you're reading along, you can refer back and forth. That's the way to do it.
Right, right.
So, okay, so that's the famous Third Secret of Fatima incident that really makes Malachi Morton an important figure in talks and debates about Fatima and about Vatican II. Speaking of Vatican II, because Malachi Martin was in the Holy Land and doing some archaeology and whatnot, he becomes associated with Jewish leaders, rabbis, both in the Holy Land and in Rome and Italy, such as Rabbi Abraham Heschel. 1961, Heschel. 1962. And because of this, Pope Paul VI, in January of 1964, chooses Malachi Martin to be one of his guides or companions for his pilgrimage to the Holy Land in January 1964. So I think this shows that Malachi Martin has ascended with the help of Cardinal Bea to the creme de creme of the Curia. And he has these deep ties with Israel, Cardinal Bea, who's very pro-Jewish, Paul VI, who's pro-Jewish. And then we'll see later that Malachi Martin writes a book, a pro-Jewish book regarding Paul VI, which is related to this.
And even into the 70s, he makes these two appearances with Bill Buckley on Firing Line and is still saying, even though most Malachi Martin documentarians say, but in the 70s, he's entering a new phase, a more conservative phase where he's playing to that audience more. He's still saying some really, again, I don't mean non-anti-Semitic, you know, I mean, that's great. We don't, no one here is an anti-Semite, but he's saying some really wildly enthusiastic, almost like Jews for Judaism kinds of comebacks to Christianity where mm-hmm. you're like, whoa, you're saying this to William Buckley, who's allegedly a Catholic.
Right. Yeah. So this is something you don't hear a lot about, but I think the fact that he's a companion of Paul VI to the Holy Land, January 1964. So Vatican II ends in 65. Just get everybody their timeline. 62 to 65 is Vatican II. So during the council, January 64, Malachi Martin is in Holy Land with Paul VI. So very key. And
he did his doctoral work in archaeology at the Louvain. Mm-hmm. Which is a you know, sort of the best Catholic university in Belgium, and it's a very well known place with lots of big names coming out of Louvain in the 19th and 20th century. I don't know if we mentioned that.
Yeah, for
I
sure.
always forget that fact. Another fact about him I always forget is that for 7 years or something non negligible, this was not a 1 year editorship. where he got in arguments and then left. For 7 years, better part of a decade, he was the religious editor at National Review.
That's right. That's in the 70s.
Yeah, later in the 70s. Yeah. Okay, I forgot it was that late.
72, 78. We'll hit it.
Yep.
We'll hit it. Yeah, but that's also very important. And he has a lot of connections.
Super important.
In New York after this period. But after the Holy Land incident, that's January 1964. Later in 64, it seems that maybe in the first part of the year, there is a scandal in which Robert Blair Kaiser, who had been an ex-Jesuit, he had been a Jesuit for 9 years, left, was laicized, got married to a woman named Susan, who Malachi Martin refers to as Sue. Other people refer to her as Sue, and allegedly has an affair with Sue Kaiser, the wife of the ex-Jesuit. Now, Robert Blair Kaiser, this is the ex-Jesuit husband, he was Time Magazine's correspondent in Rome. So this is Vatican II. Vatican II is still going on. And he's a Jesuit. He knows the main Jesuits like John Courtney Murray, Bea, Malachi Martin, and he's hanging out with them, and they're going to dinner parties and hanging out. We know this from John Courtney Murray. They'd only been married 3 years. Robert Blair Kaiser accuses Malachi Martin of having an affair. She is pregnant. And I couldn't find anywhere in any of the literature if there's any accusation that the baby was Malachi's or if it was Robert's. But she was pregnant when this sexual scandal came out.
There's never an accusation by him. There's a documentary on Netflix. And I've watched it, I think, three times. And he features prominently in it. He keeps getting interviewed, Robert Kaiser.
Okay.
And he never, ever met as often, as bitterly as he's talking about Malachi Martin. He never says he sired a love child with my wife. So I don't think he ever.
But does he speak of the affair?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. He talks about it as a matter of fact. But he never, ever, I don't think he ever accused. I mean, it was a tough situation not to make light of it. You want that kid to be yours, but I don't think he ever accused Malachi Martin of being the father or whatnot.
Because there was a priest named Father William Casey. I believe we have the letter still extant that's been saved, signed and dated. And he states, from what he could gather, that the affair was going on for 2 years.
Okay.
So it's quite some time. I read the full article. It was interesting because he went and met with Sue and he's like, what are you doing? This is against the Catholic religion, adultery, divorce and all that. And she said, well, since Robert had been a Jesuit and his formation, he was never really properly formed to be a husband. And it's been a horrible marriage. And his response to her was, so you're going to marry Malachi Martin, who was also formed as a Jesuit?
Right.
And he says she laughed at the irony. That's what was in the letter.
Right. But this is the letter from John Courtney Murray?
No, this is, I think, the letter from Father William Casey. There's another letter from Father John Courtney Murray, who was a big shot at Vatican II. He basically, I think he's credited for writing the Religious Liberty Decree. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, by and large. Yeah.
And he wrote a letter to Robert Kaiser in of July 1964. So this is pretty shortly after, and in which he says, I'm really sorry that this happened, that Malachi Martin did this to your wife, did this to your marriage. So Father John Courtney Murray, who's a pretty famous guy, is acknowledging that an affair happened and that Malachi Martin was guilty of it. It's not allegedly. It's affirmed in that letter. Again, we have that letter. It's dated July 10th, 1964.
Yeah, it's good evidence, documentary evidence. I mean, it's still not a smoking gun because Robert Kaiser theoretically could have just lied to John Courtney Murray.
And Robert Kaiser did, defenders of Malachi Martin say, look, Robert Kaiser did check into a sanitarium and had major mental issues. And so he was just hallucinating, paranoia. He made up this affair in his own mental instability. That's there.
Right.
But as I looked into it, I see that there's two other sources that are speaking of it. Father John Courtney Murray in his letter speaks of Malachi Martin leaving the Jesuits, and this is the exact phrase, I pulled it. He speaks of Malachi Martin's apostasy from the society on June 27th, 1964. So Murray, who had looked into it, he says apostasy from the Society of Jesus.
It's not either way. It's an odd expression.
It's more like a dishonorable discharge than it is an honorable discharge.
Right. But of course, what Martin would maintain all his life is he left the Jesuits. He was dispensed from two of his three vows, but he never left the priesthood, and even says this I always found laughable, who said he was secretly made a bishop. So
right.
He claimed he was never laicized. When you read Murray's turn of phrase there, apostasy from the Jesuit, it does sound more like he's no longer a religious at all, no longer a priest at all. I mean,
yeah. And then in 1997, so Malachi Martin died in 99, and he became really famous in I think he started going on Art Bell in like 95, 96, and he was selling a lot of books. He was exploding, and people were writing to the Vatican saying, what's the story on this guy? Is he Father Malachi Martin, Mr. Malachi Martin, Dr. Malachi? Who is this guy? I'm going to read you the official decree from the Congregation for Institutes of Consecrated Life and Societies of Apostolic Life. It is protocol number, in case you're interested, 04300/65. And it's dated June 25th, 1997. So this is close to the end of his life. It reads, quote, in 1965, Mr. Martin, notice this is Mr., not Father. In 1965, Mr. Martin received a dispensation from all privileges and obligations deriving from his vows as a Jesuit and from priestly ordination, end quote.
There it is.
So the clarification from 1997 says that he was dispensed from both being a Jesuit, a religious, and priestly ordination, which is why he's not walking around wearing a cassock. He's not wearing a collar on Art Bell. He's not going by Father Malachi Martin. He has been canonically laicized. He's removed from the clerical state. And that happened in 1965.
In other words, it's a damnable lie what he's saying about being a secret priest that was, you know, dispensed of two of three vows, but he still keeps the vow of celibacy.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So some things, and also in the letter of Father Casey, which is quite long, it's three or four pages, he in there states that Sue, the adulterous wife, Sue told him that Malachi had already begun the process of laicization so that he could marry her.
Right.
That's what Sue told the priest. Now, she could have been deceived. She had moved away and she was living in Phoenix, Arizona. He actually went all the way out there to talk to her because they had been friends way back and in Rome and wanted to find out what the story is. And she told him Malachi was going to get laicized to marry her. It obviously never happened.
Which allegedly he told, he was a serial liar, and he told a slew of women something similar, right. According to his set of incontest.
His brother allegedly said that this happened with four women and maybe a guy. He said
no.
four women and maybe a man.
A man might have slipped in there one way or another. There's no way to know.
Who knows? Not quite sure on that one.
I did not hear that.
You didn't hear that one. Okay.
Wish I hadn't, but.
Yeah. So, yeah, but Malachi had basically maintained that he was still a priest. He still said mass every day, and he was an exorcist. I'm going to get to that in just a moment. Now, here's the part in Malachi Martin's life that's super sketchy, Tim. This is 1965 all the way up until 1976. All right. In 66, he moves to Washington, D.C., and he gets a Guggenheim Fellowship. So he's getting some money. He's doing some writing. He receives a second Guggenheim Fellowship in 1969, and he writes a book called The Encounter, Religion and Crisis, Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux, published in 1969 in New York. The next year, he becomes a citizen of the United States of America. In 72, he writes a book, Three Popes and the Cardinal, The Church of Pius, John, and Paul, and its encounter with human history. It's a liberal book.
Encounter gives that away. Encounter with Human History tells you.
If you ever see Encounter,
lib.
Yeah, not good. In 1973, he writes this book, Jesus Now. I'm going to throw this. You got to see the book cover on this, people. I'm going to throw this up on the screen. There it is. This is Malachi Martin's Jesus Now. And here's the subtitle. It's offensive. How Jesus has no past and will not come again, and in loving action is dissolving the molds of our spent society, by Malachi Martin. Jesus Now, 1973. It only has 3 reviews on Amazon.com. Does not look like a big seller right now. I don't even want to waste my time and order it and read it.
I never even heard of that one before this morning. That what did Gruner in the SSPX say about that? That typically defend him.
I don't think that's as widely known that he wrote this book.
Yeah, and, I mean, I've just never heard.
Jesus has no past and will not come again. What?
Yeah. Yeah.
And the cover, it just screams liberals 70s.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's 1973. Now, I have a pet theory here, Tim. You know what else happened in 1973?
Exorcist.
The Exorcist film
Roe
came out.
Roe versus Wade.
Yeah.
A lot happened.
A lot happened. Exorcist. But in 1973, the Exorcist film came out and it blew up. And ever since that moment, he starts writing about the paranormal,
that's right,
the demonic, exorcisms, and he recreates himself as an experienced exorcist.
Right.
You see this on Art Bell. His first appearance on Art Bell was him as exorcist.
I know.
He has no history, it seems, with exorcism, but as soon as the movie comes out in 1973, he knows a little something about it.
Or claims to know a lot about it.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Claims that he's like, what is the connection between, Gabriel Amorth and Malachi Martin? I've seen,
they
knew each other. Yes, there is.
Okay.
They did. I'm 95% sure they knew each other, and it was either very friendly or very unfriendly. I forgot about Gabriel Amorth. People say Gabriel Amorth was a shyster as well.
Yeah, I don't know. I've always thought of him as trustworthy, but
I've always thought of him as trustworthy too. But he also has, he was told by Malachi Martin the secret, allegedly.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. Yeah, I'm just remembering a story I read about 6 months ago. They definitely knew each other.
Okay.
And I'm forgetting exactly how friendly it was, but I think he believed his Fatima rantings. Anyway, sorry, didn't mean to cut you off there. So you're saying,
I'm just writing a note here because I'm going to look it up later.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm
cool. Yo.
Yeah. Go on. I might look it up.
You just threw a giant wrench in a machine.
Yeah.
There we go. Okay. So there's, so in 1973, The Exorcist comes out. Also in 73, he was interviewed by the Cincinnati Inquirer, and he quotes, "I saw cardinals sweating in front of me and I began to enjoy it." This is an interview. So he's also starting to present himself as this sort of cleric in the Vatican with secret knowledge, and there's these corrupt cardinals and he's got the dirt on them, which he's going to, over time, he's going to switch more and more away from the exorcist, but well, maybe combine it with the exorcist to the, I've got the dirt on the cardinal story.
It's kind of what Windswept House is, right?
Precisely.
I mean, it's kind of the combination of these. Yeah.
Which is his, most famous book.
Right.
And then, as you had mentioned, from 72 to 78, he was the religion editor at National Review.
Right. Right. So, 72 to 78. Yeah. I said 7 years, six. Yeah. That's a big post. I mean, he's working it.
He's a writer.
He's on the East Coast. He is making this work. I mean, that's a good gig. Yeah. And remember, he's come over here, was at first just naturalized, and is, having to make his way in the world, no longer being with the Jesuits, no longer having his meal ticket. And it is remarkable, as the SETE critics of Martin point out, you can't deny what they say. This is a meteoric rise.
Yes. I mean,
tremendous. This is a rocket launch from the time where you're just there might be career. There's a lot of careerism in the priesthood, and he might have been engaged in that. But once he left the Jesuits, it's like, dude, he goes fast and he works his way to the top of the secular publishing world under different auspices in the late 60s versus the middle 70s. But the common theme is that he's tremendously successful at the publishing game.
Absolutely.
So I think your theory about Exorcist sounds good at a first blush.
I think he's, you know, he's poking around. I forgot to mention one thing I need to throw back. In 1964, before he was released from his vows, he wrote a book under a pseudonym, Michael Serafian.
Michael Serafian. Yep.
Called The Pilgrim, Pope Paul VI, the Council in the Church at a Time of Decision, which was about the Jewish question, the role of the Jews and how they would be presented at Second Vatican Council. That's important, but it kind of goes with everything we were saying before, but I forgot that point. Back to what you were just saying, 1976, he wrote his first bestseller. It was called Hostage to the Devil, Possession and Exorcism of Five Living Americans.
Yeah.
And it was about Satanism and possession and all that. That came out in 76. So my take on Malachi Martin, just a theory, folks, is he got involved with this woman. She was an American. He moved to America. It didn't work out. He's living in New York City and he's writing articles and he's writing these kind of crummy books like, what was it? Jesus Now? Yeah.
Jesus Now. He's Apocalypse writing, Now?
Yeah. Not Apocalypse Now. Jesus Now. Just how Jesus has no past and will not come again. Just crummy stuff. And no one's buying this. And right. Then in 73, there's a turn in the culture towards, you know, the paranormal and horror movies, exorcism. And he's like, okay, I'll write a book on that. I'm a religious writer for the National Review. I'll focus on true exorcisms that have happened in America because everybody's interested in this movie, which was allegedly a true story. I'll write a book about American exorcisms. Boom, bestseller. And it's right. At this point, mid 70s, he's like, okay, I've got a niche.
Right.
I got a bestseller, and I'm going to run with it. So from then on, he's publishing books like in 1978, The Final Conclave. That's about the death of John Paul I.
Right.
He writes Vatican, a novel. Again, talks about John Paul I, Paul VI, all that stuff. And then he's also writing books like The Jesuits, The Society of Jesus and the Betrayal of the Roman Catholic Church, The Keys of This Blood, The Struggle for World Dominion Between Pope John Paul II, Mikhail Gorbachev, and the Capitalist West.
These are all super timely. Think of the development of that as you go into the 80s.
Yes.
The Keys of This Blood, he talked a lot about on Art Bell. It was the main book he's quoting from in the second Art Bell interview.
Okay. Wait, which book was that? I missed it.
Keys of This Blood,
yeah.
Because, I mean, look who he's talking to. What all the skeptics say is that he was just really swift at, he took him, when he'd meet someone new, it'd take him 2 to 5 minutes to size him up, and then he can feed him exactly what they want to hear. Feed him the milk and honey.
That's right. So if he meets a Jew from New York City, he can start talking about rabbis and ones he knew in the Middle East and Rome and all that. The
Nostra Aetate, what it means.
Cardinal Bea's input, Paul VI, how he went with Paul VI. And then if he meets a trad, well, then he figures you out. He's like talking about exorcists. He's talking about, you know, problems at the council, guilty cardinals. So he's got his toolbox. He just figures out who he's talking to and adjusts accordingly.
Yeah. If you're a liar and you're pretty swift, it's not that hard to do, I guess.
Yeah. And, you know, this is a good opportunity to turn to the Art Bell show. I had heard excerpts and parts of the Art Bell interviews for, you know, a long time. I never knew who Art Bell was. I never knew. And I looked him up. It's the Coast to Coast show. And listen to this, people. Topics discussed include near-death experience, climate change, cosmology, quantum physics, remote viewing, hauntings, contact with extraterrestrials, psychic readings, metaphysics, science and religion, conspiracy theories, Area 51, Ouija boards, crop circles, cryptozoology, Bigfoot, and and get this, Hollow Earth Hypothesis. So this is the kind of show.
Yeah, the cryptozoology. So now I don't want people to think I was crazy. I would listen to for the purposes of laughing in 2005, 2006, 2007, when when I was first married, teaching high school, but also college. I taught at Compton Community College.
Straight out of Compton?
Tim
is straight out of Compton. This is a meme, people. Get on it. We need a straight out of Compton meme.
I have a sweatshirt that says Compton Community College, and people literally will come up to me and they'll be like, dude, that's mean. I was like, no, I taught there. It used to be a thing. It was financially corrupt. I was teaching Plato and Aristotle to kids at Compton. I'm not kidding. A common excuse for absence is I got to go to my cousin's funeral or whatever.
Right, straight out of Compton.
It was real. So I was traveling on Monday nights and Thursday nights for my first two married years before I went to Rome to study with Greg, from Bakersfield, where I live again, to Compton, CA.
That's pretty far.
It's a 2-hour drive. Yeah. With LA traffic, can be in anything. But I preferred the Thursday night classes to Monday night because Thursday is pre-weekend, as I call it. But, you know, so you can be a little tired.
I've never seen that on your resume. Is that on there?
It's on there. Taught a year and a half at Compton College, taught a year at Bakersfield College. It's just a community college. But the point is, my wife and I, when we would be going back, going through the transverse ranges there, which separate Bakersfield from the LA area, you pass through the mountains. And as long as we could keep it, we'd be listening to Coast AM with that funny music, the famous music from Coast to Coast AM. They even used that song in the movie Hot Rod, just because it's so well known. It's so associated with Art Bell. And his favorite topic, what you read is cryptozoology, is he would talk about interspecial animals, and he'd have people call in and say if they'd seen any. And his very favorite topic in the time period I was listening, 06, 07, was shadow people, not mentioned there. There's this whole...
Tell me about it. Well, first off, I'm not quite... So cryptozoology, are those things like Bigfoot who we haven't seen, or are those more like ligers that are ligers and tigers or lions and tigers?
I don't know about you, but I put them in the same ontological category. What is Bigfoot, Nessie, and liger?
Okay, so that's cryptozoology?
Real? Yeah.
Because ligers are real. Ligers
are real?
They're real.
Okay, well, I don't know.
They're pretty much my favorite animal.
Yeah, that's pretty touche.
Yeah.
Pretty much my favorite animal.
Yeah.
That was a good working.
Yeah.
No, I didn't know they were real. I thought they were like Nessie or the what's it called? The Board for Peaceful Association with Nessie.
Mm-hmm. That he mentioned. Yeah. To blow Nessie out of the water.
Oh man. No, I think cryptozoology is more of these made up animal species people would call in and claim they'd seen.
Okay.
Nessie, Bigfoot.
Got it.
But he was always on the shadow people thing. I think the shadow people hypothesis, it's like, you know, you look in the corner of the room and you can only see them out the corner of your eye, and they're this whole other species. It's hard to say with a straight face.
I would just call that a demon.
Yeah, but you'd call it a demon if
there was a shadowy black
religious tradition
figure in my room. I'd be like, there's a demon right there. It's my St. Benedict medal.
Right.
Holy water.
No, yeah. I know. He also, remember about 3 years ago, it became really popular. There was a Netflix documentary on, what's it called? When you're awake, sleep paralysis.
Okay.
And shadow people got brought up then, and Art Bell, from what I heard, was back at it. You know, you'd see shadow people when you came to. You never heard of sleep paralysis?
No.
All the high school kids were talking about it after that thing came out. You wake up and you're paralyzed, and a shadow person comes and sits on your chest, and I don't know why, but it was just ridiculous. I mean, these are the trappings of the occult that have made its way into our culture. The more paganism has returned, because man has a fixation with metaphysics.
Yes.
And even non-religious people will go to the occult. All these people, by the way, I deal with in Southern California that have ever, particularly religious people, that ever worked in Hollywood, they all tell me the same thing, right? I was talking to a Guadalupe kind of self-appointed expert that used to work in Hollywood, a guy and his wife. He's a fan of your show, by the way. And he was saying like, oh man, it's so widespread. You're working, you know, as a composer for TV and movies, and you go to a dinner party and people just whip out tarot cards. People just whip out, they're into divination. Mm-hmm. They whip out. So the point is, Art Bell comes from that. I don't know if you want to call it tradition. It's no more a tradition than
right.
some made up religion from 20 years ago is, but it has its permanent place in the human psyche. And there's no better representative of this than Art Bell. He always seemed really, embracing of the Catholic stuff. He loved the New World Order stuff. Malachi mm-hmm. Martin was telling him he was just spitting, listen to those interviews, people. He is lit up with happiness to be talking to a smart guy that's validating not all of this, but some of it. He never talked about shadow people.
Well, that's one of the strange things about Malachi Martin is he's on this show, people. You know, he's not being interviewed by Mother Angelica on EWTN. Right. He's on the Art Bell show.
Right.
This is shadow people and Ligers and hollow earth hypothesis. I'm really curious about that. Hollow earth hypothesis.
I don't know that one.
I don't either. And apparently there's I found one page that had quotes from Malachi Martin on Art Bell that were heretical. You ever heard of this? Seen it? I didn't have time to compile them.
Never.
But there is a site out there. Look it up. Google it. Get your fingers.
Gotta be the Sede's put that out.
Oh, I'm sure they did. And we'll talk about that in a minute. Why does Sede Vacantist not like Malachi Martin? So yeah, 1996, he appears on the Art Bell show. The first show, I believe, was on exorcism relating to his book. And also in the late 90s. So remember, he dies in 99. So this is working at the last 3 years of his life. He begins to make a lot more claims. He turns back to the Fatima stuff. This is when he's promoting that he heard the third secret. He's a big advocate of Father Gruner. Mm-hmm. He says, quote, Father Gruner is fulfilling a desperately needed function in an ongoing perception of Mary's role in the salvation of our imperiled world. Father Gruner is absolutely correct that the conversion of Russia, as Our Lady desired, has not been executed, end quote. So in 96, Malachi Martin's going on the record and saying the consecration of Russia hasn't happened. Again, you and I don't think it has either. We have a lot of qualifications on that in our previous videos, but our argument doesn't rely on Malachi Martin or Gruner.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
Did Gruner was a, he believed in a fake Lucia.
Gruner was the popularizer of the two sister Lucy's thesis.
We need to do a show on that where we do the pictures and side by sides and all that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't believe in that, but we get asked a lot in the comments. Hey, what about the two Lucias? When are you going to talk about that?
She has an overbite in one picture and an underbite in the next. That's Gruner. So, right. And did they, I don't know if Gruner and Martin ever met, but they would praise each other in public Art Bell type interviews. Yeah. And I'm not sure if they ever came together and
I've never
joined
seen a photo of them together. So, also in 97, Malachi Martin claimed that Cardinal Siri was elected twice, including in 1978 at the, I'm not sure if it was the John Paul I or John Paul II conclave. Do you know?
John Paul I.
So
he claimed Siri was elected before John Paul I, I think.
I think he claimed that he was elected in 58 and that he was elected again in 78.
Oh, he claimed he was elected in 58, too. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, he was elected twice. Right. Yeah, and a lot of Sede Vacantists will say that Siri was elected in 58, and he was kind of, that was the real election, and he declined it. And then
that's right.
Roncalli, they took another vote, and Roncalli got it. He became John the 23rd. But that Roncalli, because he was a Freemason, could not become Pope. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, also in 1977, Malachi Martin claimed that he knew that Roncalli and Montini were Freemasons.
Really?
Yeah. So
really?
You can see Malachi Martin's making some very bold stuff in the last 2 years of his life.
Right.
He says John the 23rd was a Freemason. Montini's. Remember, Malachi Martin went to the Holy Land as a tour guide, as a friend of Montini of Paul VI. But now in these later last 2 years, he's saying he was a Freemason.
I didn't know he said that about either of them. Yep. That's people are seeing a real light bulb moment. Normally we, so I didn't know that. What book do you know where he said that? That's interesting.
I didn't write down the source, but these are just the notes that I've been scouring over the last several weeks.
Boy, he is all over the place. I mean, he's truly all over the place. The more
it's
I'm thinking
really
about
the last 2 years. And then in 97, as I mentioned before, the Vatican comes out with the statement from the Congregation for the Institutes of Consecrated Life and says, look, he was dispensed from being a Jesuit and a priest in 65. And they call him Mr. Martin. So I think they kind of want to wash their hands of him.
Yeah.
Because he's making all of these claims.
Right. Right.
He also in 97, do you know about the Thucline ordinations? So the Sede Vacantis, most of them follow what's called Thuc lines, T-H-U-C. And this was a Vietnamese kind of rogue bishop who went and consecrated a bunch of bishops outside the Catholic Church. And if there's any Sede Vacantis bishops out there, they primarily come from this Archbishop Thuc.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That's where I was wondering where they come from.
Yeah, they come from Archbishop Thuc. And in 1997, Malachi Martin went on the record and said that these were valid consecrations. These are real bishops out there, which kind of shows Malachi Martin starting to go further Sede, right?
Yeah.
And then he also claimed at this time that he was consecrated as a bishop by Pius XII secretly. Okay.
Right.
So then I'm going to put a picture on the screen. All right. Everybody can see it. There's what looks like a bishop on the left. There's a priest getting ordained on the floor. And then there's a man in a cotta, a lace cotta. That's Malachi Martin. This is an ordination in like 97 or 98. And this is a Sede Vacantis bishop ordaining a married man who promised to be continent and not have a relationship with his wife. During this ordination, there was doubt whether the guy did it correctly. And so Malachi Martin, who you can see in the picture right there assisting, he says, well, I'm a bishop too. I was made a bishop by Pius XII secretly. So why don't I redo the entire ordination ceremony just so we know for sure that this is a valid priestly ordination. And so he went on and did the ordination again on this guy who is named Dr. Kumaraswamy.
Yeah, Raswami.
And then became
right.
Father Kumaraswamy. This whole thing is said, the bishop is Sede Vacantis, the doctor slash father is Sede Vacantis. Malachi Martin is present at a Sede Vacantis ordination ceremony. And he dies in 1999, a year or so later, July 27th. He receives last rites from Father Paul Wickens, who is a radical traditionalist priest, has his own chapel. I think he said of a contest. I couldn't find any details on it. He's not, within any organization like the Society of St. Pius X. He seems to be outside of that. And he seems to be said of a contest. And then, like I said at the beginning of the show, he's buried with this Greek woman with whom he lived. She had been married before. I don't know if she were divorced or widowed. Her name was Kakia Livanos.
I don't think she was ever divorced. She was still married when she was living with him, I believe.
Yikes.
And she was a benefactrix.
Yes.
To him as well.
She was a sugar mama.
She was sugar mama. And yeah, when he ever spoke of it, he just talked about it as she was a fellow traveler. She believed in his work.
She was a housekeeper who paid him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. Exactly. She was married. And I do not believe she never got divorced. There's a chance her husband died.
I don't know the details. I knew she had been married, but I don't know what happened to her husband. It's really the Art Bell years, 96 to 99. Those are the last 3 years. He gets kooky, folks. I mean, yeah, we can clip things out of the Art Bell and say, this shows this on Fatima, this shows this. But, he's also claiming that Roncalli and Montini were Freemasons, which would make them anti-popes. They wouldn't be valid popes if that were true. He's buddied up with Father Gruner. He's participating in Sede Vacantis ordinations. I mean, it's sketchy. And so I'm not going to base any of my history or theology or Fatima conclusions on Malachi Martin.
Right. Right. But there's after his. Yeah, neither would I, obviously. But there's the important counterpoint there to push back is that, as we've said in recent shows, much of what he said, whether or not it's what Aristotle would call accidentally correct or essentially correct, meaning he, you know, proper answer with the proper justification or proper answer that's, you know, like a clock being right twice accidentally by day without the proper justification. A lot of what he said seems to be vindicated by the recent news, the news of the last 6 months, the even in, you know, the Buffalo priest that was ritualistically murdered, the Wisconsin priest that was ritualistically murdered, the woman that came. I mean, there was a story just on the day after Christmas about, you know, the child porn priest gets busted, and in his account on his server, he's talking about child sacrifice being important to priests that have gone rogue and things like that. So remember, this is the trick. This is the enigma of Malachi Martin. I'm not tying my wagon to his star by any means. Neither are you. But he was at least pseudo vindicated by things that have been happening in the church, really, not just the last year, the last 5 to 10 years. There's this letter by a guy named Bernard Jansen, which gets quoted some. And he wrote this in response to Tempter's Hour, one of Martin's most popular faction novels, fact fiction. Just kind of his whole life, as people have commented.
Yeah, his life is faction.
His life
and
is faction.
Faction is fiction based on fact, just for those who don't know.
Which I think is what we're talking about
which
here.
Which is the life of Malachi Martin, yeah.
Right, which is kind of even the phenomenon of right conclusion, maybe wrong premises, whatever. Listen to what Jansen says. It says, "Dear friends and benefactors," this is in re Tempter's Hour, "during Malachi Martin's lifetime, his writings and statements were frequently criticized for being excessively alarmist. Yet, again and again, Father Martin's conclusions were eventually proven correct. This has now happened again. The first chapter of his book, Windswept House, provides graphic details of the Satanist infiltration of Rome at the time of the Second Vatican Council. Some of Malachi Martin's critics said that this view was excessively alarmist," which is bad writing. Alarmism is always excessive, Mr. Jansen. Anyway, "however, last year, Rome's chief exorcist, Father Gabriel Amorth, said that satanic sects are operating within the Vatican, with members reaching all the way up to the College of Cardinals. Father Amorth stated, when one speaks of the smoke of Satan in the holy sanctuary, it is all true." End quote. "Indeed, satanic infiltration is the only way to explain some of the horrific scandals that have engulfed the church. Satanist penetration of the Vatican is one more proof," I'm not sure that it's self-approved, it needs to be proved, "but that we are indeed living through the time of the evil one's dominion over the earth." Then he goes on, he says, "this is the theme of our new book, The Tempter's Hour by Malachi Martin. Yet this book also includes a message of hope." And he goes on to, you know, push the book. But, you know, he's raising real points here that Martin is not, you know, even if we're saying there's some diabolic, deuced style lying in here, the devil does mix lies with truth. And not all of his claims, not all the claims that, because they're largely emblematic of some of the things we've been doing shows about, not all of them, none of them really, have been misproven or disproven. He's talking about things as they became relevant. All that's getting thrown into question is whether or not he really believed them or whether he was just this paltry opportunist.
Right. Right. My guess is that he knew a lot of stuff back in the 50s and the 60s, especially being an associate of Paul VI and Cardinal Bea. And Bea, of course, has all the info going back to Pius. He's the confessor of Pius XII. Not that Bea would have broken the seal of confession, but we're talking about a guy who's in, you know, within the soul of the Pope Pius XII. So he's connected to Pius in a way to Pius XII, John the 23rd and Paul the 6th. And then he goes AWOL in 64, 65. And he kind of has this, hey, I'm a hippie liberal ex-priest time in New York City. And then he gets success with talking about exorcism. And then in the final 2-3 years, all the really crazy, outrageous claims. And so I think, you know, that says it all. I think we could take some time, Tim, and talk about the different way factions or, you know, groups in the church have received or rejected Malachi Martin. Before we do, though, while you were talking, I looked up Kakia Livanos, the Greek woman he lived with. She was divorced. Yeah. And then also, you know, for me, the most alarming thing in Malachi Martin's corpus is Windswept House. If you read it's either the first or second chapter. Is it the very first or the second? Anyway,
I thought it's
in the first couple chapters. There's this satanic ritual of enthroning of Satan in the Vatican. And at the same time, there's one done in, I think it's Charleston, South Carolina. I think it's the city of bishops and clergy who are also doing a similar black mass Luciferian liturgy in America. It's like these two simultaneous rites going on. And in the one in America, there's a girl, I think it's Agnes, who is raped. And there's Eucharistic horrific sacrilege and abuse. And these are the clerics and bishops. And so the opening of the book is linking the enthronement of Satan and liberalism and modernism and Freemasonry and Luciferianism in Rome in the 60s with pedophilia and child abuse and liturgical abuse in America simultaneously. And for those of us living in America and living through the Cardinal McCarrick accusations and then the Archbishop Vigano accusations, basically what we've seen in 2018, now moving into 19, is a link between corruption in Rome and corruption in America. And so everybody, including myself, is picking up a copy of Malachi Martin's Windswept House. It's actually pretty well written. There's parts of it that get tedious. Whenever he's talking about politicians, I get bored. When he's talking about churchmen, I get interested. Kind of goes back and forth. But this novel is really the story of a traditionalist Latin mass, good-hearted priest from Galveston, Houston, Texas. I like that. Fighting this evil nexus between United States bishops and corrupt cardinals in Rome. That's Winslow House. Who doesn't want to read that book?
Yeah, seriously. I know about a dozen people that are reading it right now.
Yeah. That's what we're doing the show.
Dozen.
Because everyone wants to know, is this legit? Mm-hmm. Do I take this for gospel?
Right. We got so many requests to do it. And I haven't read Windswept House, but I was about to pick it up over Christmas. And I just always have this pause. And I know it's more interesting to hear someone talk about something that's committed to it, the way I'm committed to the Fatima message or the Akita message or Thomism, than it is to hear somebody say, I don't know. Here are the facts. I'm so on it. I'm not sure. There is something here, but I don't know how much. And I think the source is bad, which is kind of what we said about right. JP1. Is he assassinated? I don't know. There's something there for people to, you know, provide impetus for them to go do their own research. And it's interesting to talk about because some things on public record are verified, but the conclusion that they lead one to are not at least at this point verifiable. I put Malachi Martin in that category strongly, where it's like, there's some real stuff here. People are not just looking into his works because some stupid trendy reason. Cosmo magazine mentions it, and then all of a sudden, the next month they're getting a bunch of hits. There's because people are saying, this is literally what happened to me. Everyone I know that asked me for nonfiction and fiction recommendations, because, you know, I'm a Catholic theology philosophy teacher, like, and I say, oh, do this. Everyone says, wasn't there some guy, you know, they're talking about Martin, that was kind of known as a crackpot, but was kind of known for you know, being sharp that wrote on this? Yes. And that, so the, it's worth another look. It's worth looking into. Yeah. That's why we're doing the show.
Yeah. I mean, I think Windswept House is a good read. It shows that there's corruption in Rome, corruption with American cardinals, and a guy from Texas straightens it out. Traddy from Texas. I like that story all day long. You know, I buy that for everybody for Christmas. That's a good story, especially when the Traddy's from Texas. Because Windswept House is like a big mansion down in Galveston, Texas.
It's
like the headquarters, it's of this family who are like, we don't like Vatican II, we don't like liberals, we don't like modernism. So they're kind of this rich people who can buy off their way to have their own little Latin Mass chapel up at Windswept House in off the coast of Texas. Yeah.
I always thought the title was, in my ignorance, was an extended analogy for the Vatican.
Well, I think it's sort of like two towers, right?
Got it.
You got the Windswept House Trad Chapel in Texas, and then you got this maybe demonic Windswept House in Rome.
That's interesting. So I really should just read it.
Yeah,
I need to read your book, your fiction book, and I need to read Windswept House, among other things. Yep. It's Catholic fiction, Catholic faction.
I would say read it, but don't go mentioning it as gospel.
Read it as fiction. Don't read it as faction. Maybe it's more fact fiction, but we don't know the degree to which you put it in category A or B. Just read it the same way you read Father Elijah.
When I look at Malachi Martin's life, I don't see any period of his life where I'm like, he's a solid guy. He starts off as a Jesuit. Not so sure about that. Then he has an affair, allegedly. I'm not so sure about that. Then he's like a liberal religion op-ed writing Jesus Now books. I'm not so sure about that. And then he's on Art Bell making fantastic claims that are really out there and attending Sede Vacantis ordinations. Again, there's no spot in his life where I'm like, he was pretty solid right there.
Well, maybe people will respond. Maybe during the middle 70s when he's religion editor for National Review, he does some interviews with Buckley. I mean, even then, you're right. He's still saying some wacky things on Firing Line with Buckley. But I think that when you watch his morphology, I mean, that's probably the period in his life where he's kind of the closest to SSPX before he goes, by the end, I guess, SSPV or whatnot.
Right.
I still agree, generally speaking, that even then his life is rife with contradiction. You know, I mean, well, he's still saying this enthusiastically pro-Jewish, the church has to be embarrassed and apologize for her treatment of the Jews, even into the 70s.
Sure.
That's message behind that.
Yeah. I mean, that message doesn't gel if you're, if you're a part of a Sede Vacantis movement that doesn't want to change the Good Friday liturgy from 1954. I mean, there's these things that just don't really fit. And I think we can segue into that and conclude with, how has Malachi Martin been received? We know that liberals are just like, he's a crackpot, you know, whatever. Satan wasn't enthroned in the Vatican. Come on. That never happened. Those are all good people over there in the Vatican.
The Novus Ordo is great. It was a great development.
The new liturgy was awesome. You know, John the 23rd is a canonized saint. Paul the 6th is a canonized saint. John Paul I was not murdered. There was no Vatican bank scandal. John Paul II is a saint. Yeah, people tried to shoot him in St. Peter's Square, but, you know, it wasn't. Right. Keep moving along, right? So they're just like, Malachi Martin, forget him, right? No good. Then you have people on the far right who are Sede Vacantis, who are like, in 1958, there was no pope. Vatican II was a false council. John the 23rd, not a pope. Paul the 6th, not a pope. And these people, surprisingly, do not like Malachi Martin at all. And why is that?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
It's because, and just for a quick reference before I give my response, throw the Novus Ordos, even the ones that are trying to be faithful, the JP2 fanboy types, throw them in with the liberals for in terms of, not that they are liberals, but throw them in kind of the squishy middle with the liberals in terms of their reception of Malachi Martin. They're kind of like anything. That crowd kind of just doesn't know anything. They might not even know his name. Or if they do, they'd be like, what? That's weird.
They'll say, well, no, we know in 2000 the Vatican said that was the third secret. So we just know.
That's it. That leaves just SSPX types that definitely know.
No, I think it also leads. So you also got your kind of traditional Novus Ordo type people who are like, I really just wish I could have the Novus Ordo in Latin and kneeling and communion on the tongue. And then you got your Fraternity of St. Peter and your Institute people and that whole group of people. I'm in that group, right? There's something's really whack going back into the 40s and 50s. And then really in the 60s, we see some really crazy things happening in the church. I mean,
of course. I mean, in regard specifically to Malachi Martin, there are more groups in the church than that, but they're basically, that group is usually, I mean, there's guys like me and you that are kind of in between, you know, traditionalist Novus Ordo / SSPX are all basically the same regarding Malachi Martin. Most of them kind of like him.
Yes, I would say that. And then if you talk to someone at a fraternity parish, SSPX, conservative Novus Ordo, or I go to Novus Ordo, but I wish I could go to a Latin mass, all those type people are kind of, I kind of like Malachi Martin. It's pretty cool.
Right.
You know, like, can you believe he said that? Like, well, you know, that coffee hour, that's the crowd.
Right,
but then once you turn the corner and there's Sedevacantists, they're like, Malachi Martin is a Jewish infiltrator.
Right.
He's undermining the church. Everything he said was lies.
We're not joking. That's what they say, that he's a Jewish infiltrator. And there's some, this is what makes it enigmatic. So this is what I'm saying, bracket the liberals and the sort of Novus Ordo know-nothings. And we're talking between these two groups on Malachi Martin, the traditional-minded folks, SSPX, and even, you know, really, really not high knowledgeable Novus Ordos and fraternity people. They're all in one group. And then Sedes, on the other hand, they hate him, right? And it seems to boil down to this. The Sedes seem to say, look, we're about hard facts. We don't like emotionalism.
Yeah.
The SSPX and the conservative people that still believe in
the
throne of Peter, the papacy, they claim to be, so says the Sede, these types claim to be hard facts, and they claim to be the society, sort of bad boys that have remained Catholic, and bad boys that operate on hard, unlikable facts. But really, say the Sedes, Malachi Martin is the touchstone which shows them for the sensationalist, emotionalist, personalists.
Correct.
That they criticize in the Novus Ordo enthusiast. They say Malachi Martin tells them what they want, same as those crowds say about Novus Ordo tells them what they want. And it's basically easier to buy his pack of fantastic fanatical lies about Satanism and all this and Fatima, they say, rather than just buying the bitter potion, the bitter medicine of there is no more papacy. The papacy ended. But here, and so the Sedes can sound, just because they're the really hard nosed people. If you talk to a smart Sede, they sound like, ooh, that's good rhetoric. And they can sound very fact driven. But here's where it gets counterfactual on their critique of the people who like Malachi Martin. Fatima, right? Because the Sedes accept Fatima.
I was like, as soon as you pause, I'm going to jump in and talk about Fatima, and you did it. Yeah.
No, go for it. I'll just say, with these 5 seconds.
I know that you and I believe the exact same thing, so it doesn't matter if you say it or I say it. That is, if you are a Fraternity of St. Peter, if you are a Latin Mass advocate, even if you're a reformer of the Reform, hermeneutic of continuity, SSPX, put all those people in the pile, what do we all have in common? We all believe there is a true Pope, a successor of St. Peter, and we all believe that sometime, you can say 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, but 60s, everybody's going to agree on the 60s, that something went wrong in the church. We agree that there still is a church. We're not said of a concept like, yep, God just said no more papacy, end times, or whatever however you want to interpret it. We all believe there was a pope and something went crazy wrong. this is basically almost all the videos we do, Tim. Right.
It's basically right? Our podcast.
And so yeah. What we have to do is we have to try to figure out, why did this happen? Who were the players? Did God tell us ahead of time? Is Fatima a warning?
Why? And more fundamentally, sorry to jump in.
Yeah.
What is the problem precisely? We know in a hoary way what it is,
right.
In a nebulous way. But what precisely is the problem?
Is it Vatican banks? Is it Freemasonry? It's obviously modernism. It's a failure to see Fatima and seriously and obey the Fatima message. All of these things, right? And so if you're in, so you got the kind of the liberal, you know, maybe go to church most Sundays and just whatever the church says, cool. And then you got sede vacantes, the people in the middle who are actually trying to make it work, like the Pope is real, but Catholicism in 2019 is way different than Catholicism was in 1919.
Almost like two different religions.
Almost.
We're not going to say very damn near.
But it looks so different and feels so different. And it's not just liturgy. It's not just theology. It's all these scandals and monetary scams and everything that's coming out now. Right. So we're looking for the prophetic, the apocalyptic, the theological. We're looking for all of those hints. Right. And so the sede vacantes says you guys are open to emotional manipulation and sensationalism. And Malachi Martin is just the worm on the hook for you guys. It's perfect.
That's right. That's right. But that's very well said, perfectly said. But here's where I come back at the settes. And there are some really sharp ones out there that you can hear talk. They can be very alluring, very winsome and convincing. But here's the thing. They're not Fatima deniers. And also, they're not 3B deniers. They're like, yeah, 3B. So once you get all the way into the connection
also deny that 3A is the real thing.
Most of them do.
Yeah, because they don't believe John Paul II was a real pope, and so whatever he gave them in 2000 was just
silly. So you're right. I guess all of them. But yeah, 3A matters less than almost any of them.
We believe in 3A and 3B. They only believe in 3B, by which they mean 3.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
We have to posit 3A and B3 because we believe John Paul II was a true pope.
Right. And we're saying that, like, even Cardinal Bertone / Sedano, who presented it in 2000, mm-hmm. in whatever, May of 2000, we're not actually lying. They're mental reservationing it and saying, well, here's part of the secret. We're just going to present it with a wink and a nod as the whole secret. But that's exactly right. They don't have 3A because they don't have a pope anymore. In their thesis, the phantasmagoria of sede thesis.
Right.
Yeah. But nevertheless, they believe there is a 3. They believe it probably is basically apocalyptic. It is ecclesiological. The church is all but dead, or however they would say it.
I think they would say 3 was something about a council or a change in the liturgy and the end or the corruption of the papacy. And they would
which is not that far from,
and they would say, does it still exist? Did it get burned? We don't know, but it's kind of passes at this point for them because there's no pope for them.
Correct. But here's where they're wrong. You and I were talking about this before rolling tape, but then because they also accept secret 1A, 1B, 2A, 2B, there is a contradiction in their position because Sister Lucy, all over her memoirs, all over secret 2, talks about a pope must consecrate Russia.
And that it will happen.
So they have to downshift to saying, well, we meant the real failures to consecrate Russia were the actual last popes, including Pius
the 12th, Benedict the 15th.
So then it's like, okay, but what about the era of peace after the consecration? What about Russia's good role? They have nothing to say on that.
They basically say, well, we don't know. So, I mean, this is why I'm not a sede vacantes. Like you get to this cul-de-sac, and whether it has to do with Vatican I and there being perpetual successors on earth, you could look at Fatima prophecies, or just sort of the idea that to be Catholic is to have a papacy.
It's common sense that when you read that the gates of hell shall not prevail against the church, see, Novus Ordo types, you know, Jimmy Akin types over at Catholic Answers use that somewhat interpretive expression to mean like SSPX must be wrong. And it's like, well, that wouldn't necessarily be in this vague language. That if SSPX were right, that would not contradict the gates of hell passage of the Bible. No. Right. But I think he would be much more correct, if not outright correct, in leveling gates of hell passage of the New Testament against the set of Sedevacantists, because that really is more like, if there's no papacy, then that is more like, okay, Satan destroyed the church. It's closer to that.
They would say maybe that they're the church, so it lived on. That's what they're going to say. But it's not just that there's no papacy. It's like, oh no, we're out of popes. There's no more popes. It's that 1 billion people are following the anti-pope.
Right.
You know, and all the world's bishops and cardinals, and no one, even the Sedevacantists, the guys that are out there, like a Father Chicada and all those guys, Bishop Sanborn, even all of them say up until the mid 70s, they still believe that Paul VI was the pope. Right. There's no one out there who in 1958 called up somebody and said, hey, there's no pope after that election.
Right.
So the theology of Sedevacantists really woke up in the 70s. Mid to late 70s is when you have Sedevacantism. So basically no one knew the truth about the pope, according to them, for 15, 17 years on planet Earth.
But that's fair. I'm not saying they're right, but that would be fair because it takes the unfurling of the 60s.
Yeah, but they say if you're in communion with a false pope, you're not a Catholic. And all those guys were in communion with John the 23rd and Paul the 6th. So that means there were no Catholics on Earth until someone realized that the See of Peter was vacant.
Do all Sedevacantists believe that, what you just said, that basically that me and you are outside the church?
Yeah, they believe we're outside the church. Totally. We're in communion with the anti-pope, and we subscribe to heresy and false liturgies. Absolutely, they say that.
That sucks. I mean, because that's rough because, I mean, literally, who has the information to know? I mean, this is how Malachi Martin is at the chiasm, to use the Greek, of the X. He's weirdly at the center, kind of along with...
Because he's kind of a Sedevacantist, it seems, at the end.
At the end, he is. Well, I mean, he's doing all this stuff. But he represents the maybe the sharpest embodiment of conflict between SSPX and SSPV, the Sedes.
Well, I got to make a clarification. SSPV... tend to be officially agnostic on Sedevacantism. I just found this out in the last year.
Do they?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But there's another group that, for example, that Father Sakata and Sam Bourne and all those guys that are associated with that broke off from SSPV, and they are definitive Sedevacantists.
I did not know that.
Yeah. And they can't even go to communion at each other's churches.
Huh.
Yeah, CMRI can't go to SSPV, SPV can't go to CMRI. And it's on this, because the SSPV, Society of St. Pius V, I believe, they say it sure looks like there's no pope, but until we actually have a definitive judgment, that can't be determined. But we're going to act as if there is no pope, is basically what they
say. It's a reasonable spirit. Yeah. Well, that's not so reasonable. Yeah,
right. We're not sure, so we're going to assume that there isn't one.
Yeah, it's high stakes either side.
It's high stakes.
I mean, I forgot that that Sedes of all stripe think that we're right now basically
we're just as good as a Lutheran to them,
right? Or a pagan, right?
Well, I think they would say we're baptized.
Baptized, I guess.
But they would.
Yeah,
they would say we're not confirmed.
This is what happens. This is why schism and Reformation and all kinds of revolt, ecclesiological revolt, is so dangerous, right? This is why there's one Holy Catholic Apostolic Church, is because look at all that. I mean, this, me and you pretty much sit around. I teach it, you know, you're a PhD. Like, we sit around talking about it, thinking about it, sort of on and off, researching it all day long. And even then, it's like, oh, wow, I haven't even thought of this implication that arises out of all these factions. Sort of Protestantizing factions, and then it's like, wow, we're all alienating one another. It's agnosticism on SSPV, SSPX, Sedevacantism, just fraternity of St. St. Peter. It's all, they're all like, oh no, you're not valid. It's like, these are distinctions which turn on facts, which we simply don't have. I mean,
right. Like Malachi Martin says, John the 23rd, Roncalli is a Freemason. Okay. Let's just pause right here. If Roncalli is a Freemason, I just don't see how the man could be elected a Pope. Right. You're excommunicated. I mean,
well, that's what they say.
Yeah. I know. So it's like, so if Malachi Martin is right on that, then the fact that Malachi Martin became some sort of a sede vacantis follows. It makes sense.
Yes.
But it's like what we talked about earlier, like several videos ago, we talked about sede vacantis, and we said there are so many contingents that have to be true that it becomes ridiculous. So, for example, John the 23rd has to be a Freemason in order for this to work.
Yeah. But
how do you know that? I know there's accusations that he was a Freemason, but there's no certificate. There's no like press release from the Freemasons saying Roncalli joined today. These are facts that cannot be proved. They're right. Rumor, they're gossip. But to base whether you accept the worldwide billion person Catholic Church on a rumor that Roncalli was a Freemason and therefore not a Pope, that's high stakes gambling, man.
That is on a rumor. On that's the high basis stakes. Of a rumor.
High stakes.
Yeah.
I don't want to play like that. I'm playing $5 slots, not $5 million slots.
I know. I mean, I'm literally just reacting to all this in real time, but this is what's bothersome about it. They say, well, it's high stakes, whether you agree to it or not, because if that rumor is true, though, they say that the stakes are high this way. We would have invincible ignorance, which they might or might not accept. Mm.
They would say, hey, it's pretty obvious it's a new religion. That's what they would say.
So it sucks for everyone.
It does. I mean, I think for everybody watching, primarily most of us are in that middle group, right? We believe there is a Pope. We prefer the traditional forms. You know, I think Thomas Aquinas is a gajazillion times better than Balthazar or Rahner or de Lubach or even Ratzinger or Benedict or John Paul. Give me Thomas Aquinas. Give me Bonaventure. Shoot, I would even take SCOTUS over.
Ooh, no, I can't go there with you.
SCOTUS isn't as bad. I mean, he's
over SCOTUS over Ratzinger.
Totally, dude, all day long. Yeah.
SCOTUS is a univocist, though.
Yeah, I know. We would just bracket that point. What I'm saying is, I would take any of these old theologians, old time religion guys, versus the best, the creme de creme, the Ratzinger of post conciliar theology. Same thing when it comes to canon law. I'm buying all these canon law books. This is my new hobby lately. And I'm like, man, the 1917 code was better. It's clearer. It's just better. You know,
it's always better.
The liturgy. Yeah. I'll go all day. You know, another thing I've been studying the last 6 months is the pre 1955 Holy Week. It's just better.
Yeah.
If you know the Bible, if you know theology, if you're focused on just the typology and the analogy of the resurrection, the pre-1955 Holy Week is better. The 1962 liturgy is better than the 1970 liturgy. So I'm seeing that all the older is better. And then I also say, but the new popes are popes.
Right.
And so I've got to make that fit. Now, the liberals are like, you are ridiculous. Just accept the new stuff, man. That's what being Catholic is. Pope Francis said yesterday that's it. Period. Amoris Laetitia, no debates. Right? And the sede vacantis is like, dude, just forget the popes, man. We're in the hard position of having to somehow make this work.
Which is what the sedes say, look, you're really squeezed here. Instead of taking
says. James Martin on the left, he's saying the same thing to me.
Yeah.
He's like, you're squeezed, man. You're trying to say you're faithful to the Pope, but you're rejecting an entire document, Amoris Laetitia. What kind of Catholic are you, man?
Yeah.
It's a hard place.
They're saying it about the general situation of someone that says, look, we have popes. They just haven't been good popes for decades, you know? And I know pause here. The response a lot of people are going to have out there, hey, but what about Benedict 16? And all I would say to that, I do still have a small picture of him up in my house, full disclosure, but you got to go read Last Testament, the interview book with Peter Sievold from 2016. He says almost the exact opposite. Now, everyone knows he was a liberal in the pre-conciliar days, and he had a reform. But that reform gets called into question when he's saying things like, quote, during, and even after the council, we just wanted something other than Thomas Aquinas just because we were bored by it. And the manuals, the old manuals, we were just bored by it. It's like, dude, this is life or death. I don't risk leading souls astray from the shining path because you're bored. What do I care if you're bored? If Thomas Aquinas gets it right. I'm saying Aquinas. You said SCOTUS. I'm saying Aquinas.
No. For the record, I said Aquinas. And to make my point even more radical.
To starken it, yeah.
Yes, I would say I would even take a SCOTUS over.
Well, yeah, you're
but that
you're
was me going. That was me making a rhetorical point.
Yeah, it was
I don't want anybody making a meme on that. Do not put me in a SCOTUS cap, a dunce cap, or anything like that. I'll kill you. I'll block you on Twitter if you do that.
Or Bonaventure. I mean, Bonaventure's
cool.
He's good, but
yeah. Thomas Aquinas is 10 times better than Bonaventure and 100 times better than SCOTUS. My point is, you take the least of the scholastics. They're way better than the Nouvelle Théologie.
Yeah, sure. But Benedict did not think that. So the people out there that are stirring in your chair because I'm saying, look, Benedict might be the best from the council. I don't really know. He's to bring it back to Malachi Martin. He's almost like Malachi Martin, where Benedict is sort of at the chiasm of the X and all of this mystery and intrigue from before the council, from the 40s. To now, you know, when take the year 1942 when Sister Lucy falls ill, so ill that she actually is admonished by her bishop to write the third secret. Let's say that's sort of the modern era for the point I'm about to make. Early 40s, World War II, to now, Ratzinger, Joseph Cardinal Ratzinger, is starting shortly thereafter. Almost, he's pivotal. He's at the pivot point. He knows everything.
Everybody
that's going
always
on.
Thinks of John Paul II, right? But John Paul II was sort of an outsider. I mean, he was at Vatican II, but Ratzinger was there. He was crafting documents and phrases, and he was having the cappuccino with Rahner and Kung and Schilbeck.
He wasn't bringing it in the room, allegedly.
No, yeah, yeah. He was ordering it.
He was drinking it.
He was ordering it. And maybe Malachi Martin was bringing it in, you know?
Yeah, if Malachi Martin was alive, he'd be like, I like that. That's good. I brought him a cappuccino, too. Right. I'm changing it.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, but like, he knows where the bodies are buried.
Yeah, Ratzinger knows more than anyone, more than John Paul II. Yeah. And the story of this whole meltdown, I think, will ultimately be a story about Ratzinger.
I agree.
And just to let time out of the bag, I'm writing a book on it right now. Be out this year.
That's cool.
It climaxes in Ratzinger. In Benedict.
Yeah.
And like you said, not literally, maybe literally, I don't know, but where the bodies are buried, how everything happened through the 50s, the 60s, and the academies at the council. The implementation in the 70s, 80s, and then into the papacy of Benedict XVI, all the way up to the resignation, dude.
Even with Fatima, think of that 1984 interview he gave to Jesu magazine where he's saying this stuff about the Fatima message shouldn't be presumed to be over, and it really involves the three last things, the Novissimi. It's like, really? This is what the Vatican official story is, just JP2 getting shot and surviving, that has to do with the Novissimi? What?
Yeah.
It's got to be 3B. Yeah, well, it's wild. It's wild how much you need. All these stories by, friends of Ratzinger that said he claimed Akita as the continuation of Fatima. Then you have, Ingo Dollinger saying that Ratzinger had told him that it's about a bad council. Other guys, it might be Dollinger also saying that Ratzinger told him, he long wanted to do the contemplative second part of the papacy. I mean, there are stories all around
craziness.
It's craziness.
So I think when it comes, this is the Malachi Martin video. we'll do a, maybe we should do a Ratzinger video and kind of bring out some of the tangential, the unrelated, the contradicting statements over many decades of Ratzinger up to Benedict. But when it comes to Malachi Martin, I think what you and I are doing, Tim, on this channel and in these podcasts, I just want to put a, I want to turn the yellow light on at the intersection when it comes to Malachi Martin. I want to tell people, hey, Windswept Tiles, fun book. Trads in Texas as superheroes, I like it. But let's not make our case in public or in private based on Malachi Martin. He's a kooky guy. Mm-hmm. That's all I got to say. What do you want to say, Tim?
That's it. I'm 100% with you on that. Yeah. I've never. Yeah.
I think it would hurt us long term if we started saying what Malachi Martin said on Art Bell show.
Right.
I don't want to be in that position. I don't want my footnotes to have the word Art Bell in them anywhere.
Right. What I'll say is this. It's a paradoxical situation. It's sort of like, because we're really mainly talking about Malachi Martin for a few reasons, but mainly because of his Fatima claims. Mm-hmm. There's two or three important reasons you talk about him, but I think that's at the pinnacle. It's a paradoxical situation. This is what I tell students. Look, with regard to the third secret of Fatima, it's a lot like, not a little bit like, entrusting your last will and testament, where you're saying there's some really important things in there, the way I want my assets, you know, allocated. I have a unique set of wishes here. It's really important you do this for my wife and my kids' future happiness. It's like entrusting that to your worst enemy or to someone that has every ground to manipulate the document. That's what it is. If anywhere from a traditional minded guy who goes to the Novus Ordo like me, or Latin Mass when he can, like me, all the way to SSPX, you say there are malfeasors within the high in the Vatican that do not want the Fatima message because the content of the message is probably something having to do with the fact that they're malfeasors.
Yes.
All the way to Sedes, who say something slightly more extreme than that. I don't want to think it through or articulate it right now, but it's a paradox. It's like, you know, having your worst enemy controlling your family's fate because the content of what's in those documents would signify them. So
right.
You have to, there's nothing for it. Like Samwise Gamgee says, there's nothing for it. You have to reason through it like this, but you do have to be humble and stick only to the public record, even though because the public record, as much as these people don't like it, has betrayed itself. And so we can definitely stick to those. You don't want to stick to the manipulators like Malachi Martin or Father Gruner, the sensationalist. Right. I've always been comfortable with the Remnant guys, Chris Ferrara and Michael Matt.
Yeah, I like Matt.
Yeah. I like both of them. I think they're both smart. But then they associate themselves with Gruner. Gruner kind of had this overlap with Malachi Martin. So there's at some point there's the a shades. Bridge.
Yeah, bridge too far.
Yeah, shades kookier, to use your word. And it's like, I don't know where that leaves me exactly. This is what it is in a more extreme way, in a stepped up way, to live through, say, the Avignon papacy. The people in real time
didn't know. Yeah, they didn't know. They're like, well, maybe the Pope actually living in Rome is the Bishop of Rome. And this guy out here in Avignon, France, drinking some nice wine, Chateau du Pape, maybe he's fake. It hadn't been determined.
Right. For 70 years, it wasn't determined. They had to live their lives in between the bars.
Yes.
And that's what we're doing in a way that might be even more momentous, that it almost is guaranteed to be more momentous. So I think the other major... The wink is what you said before of this podcast. Like this is the essence. The nod is, but you become a kook when you act like your information is more actionable than it is. Your intel is more actionable than it is. So you just have to get comfortable going, almost like driving haltingly. Oh, you can drive 10 feet, then you have to brake. It's like, we just can't ever put the car in this era of the church, in this era of history. I don't feel like you can ever just accelerate, get on the highway and put it on cruise control and go forward. We always have to be checking our facts, because I don't want to be a tinfoil guy, and neither do you.
Yeah.
It's like, this is what we know. It's really dangerous.
And I think that's really what's good about our conversations, is we're honest about that.
Right.
We're not trying to push you into the thing. We're just trying to lay out the facts. We're saying Malachi Martin's got some interesting things to say. We agree with some of the things Malachi Martin says. However, if we just look objectively at the public record on Malachi Martin, it's kooky. So here's the yellow light. No speeding. Don't try to rush through this intersection because you might get T-boned.
Right.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, this is a good show. We went a little bit longer today, but lots of stuff to cover. Malachi Martin, kooky a little bit. And keep praying the rosary. That's always true. There's a good podcast last episode with Father Donald Calloway, if you didn't see that. The rosary as a weapon. It has historically been a weapon. And he talks about how the rosary was worn on the left side where the crusader kept his sword to signify that it was the weapon. So that is our weapon. That's how we fight the rosary, Our That's Lady, cool. The mysteries of the rosary, the gospel on beads. So pray the rosary every day. Other big announcement, I'll talk about it later, is I'm leading a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. I'm trying to get Tim to come. And Father Hollowell, who we saw a couple of weeks ago, he's going to be the chaplain. And we're going to have Latin masses all over the Holy Land, including the Holy Sepulchre, Nazareth, Cana, Jordan River, everywhere. So it's going to be awesome. So if you want to go to the Holy Land, 2019 is a safe time. It's a perfect time. We're going to have Latin Mass, a great preacher, Father Hallwell. I'll be doing some teaching. Hopefully we can drag Tim along, and it'll be fun. If you want to learn more, there's a link in the show notes under the video, pilgrimages.com/Taylor Marshall. You'll get all the info. So, all right, well, be Catholic, be salty, stay true, don't get worried. Christ wants you to be saved. He has a plan. Sound good? All right, signing off.
Sounds great.
Out.